Blog Talk Radio.
Experiences, some of them funny, not so funny,
I just transformed and I grew and I developed and wound up both as a respected academic and high-level policy guru or wonk, whatever you want to call them, kind of right at the center of some of the bigger social policy debates and issues of the last half century. And that's what the second book is about, which is Wayward Academic. I was in a university setting, but I spent most of my time fighting the poverty and welfare wars in the what I call the policy trenches, both at all levels of government, but up and including Washington, D.C. And so you get sort of the first story of how I got to be a policy and a wonk academic, and the second one, which really details, which really gives a reader a great perspective on the revolution in social policy of the last several decades from an insider's perspective and from kind of a little bit more on the ground level than a larger macro level.
Okay. Well, I want to give the audience bits of both books, and I'm definitely going to get to Wayward Academic in a bit. I wanted to give the audience kind of like I wouldn't say an overview, but I wanted to give them, like I said, just a glimpse into the first book. You mentioned ethnic and working class. How diverse was your neighborhood? Because I want to give people a good idea of you. How diverse was it? Say, the working class, like what type of work was prevalent in the neighborhood as far as where was everybody going to work every day?
Right. It was in many respects, it wasn't diverse at all. It was mostly Catholic, mostly Irish, and there were sections of the neighborhood, Irish, Lithuanian, Polish, and there were like five Catholic churches in the area, and they were divided by ethnicity. And there was Polish church and your Irish church and your French church and your Lithuanian church and so forth. And people would walk past the nearest church to get to their church. It was mostly Catholic, but there were some Jewish and a few kids and a few Protestant kids. No minorities whatsoever. I don't think I met a minority until I was in high school. I don't think I met a Republican until I was in college or after college. I
Oh,
mean,
wow.
so, but yeah, but in a lot of ways, it was democratic, working class. The WASPs, the Protestants, Anglo-Saxon Protestants were the enemy. Republicans were the enemy. You know, it was that kind of worldview. The communists were the enemy. A lot of prejudices, tremendous amount of prejudices, not just between white and black and white and Hispanic, but between Italian Catholics and Irish Catholics and so forth. So that was the kind of that narrow world I grew up in, and I'm part of the whole book is about breaking away from those straitjackets and embracing a much bigger world, broader world, thinking about things in more subtly and more depth, and how all that happened.
Well,
Go ahead.
that's definitely a lot of influences that you had to deal with and experience, and especially as a young person. For those who knew you as a young person growing up, what would you say that people would say that's who you are, like as far as a kid? Like, what would they say about you, and how did that change as you got older?
Yeah, it's hard to remember accurately. I mean, I'm looking at the world from inside my head, but I can only think that I look like the most ordinary kid in the world. I was actually put in a slow class in grammar school. I mean, I showed no promise whatsoever. And all we did was maraud through the neighborhood, causing mischief and, playing. I talk a lot about playing ball on the streets and, doing all the things that were typical of the 1950s and 1960s. I mean, or 1940s and 1950s. It was, a very different world where no one was concerned about, being kidnapped or anything else. Your parents just said, "Get the hell out of the house. Don't come back till supper time," and that kind of thing. So I cannot imagine anyone thought I would amount to anything, and I wasn't the greatest student in the world, but really almost until I got to college, and then things began to, my mind began to expand, I actually went into the seminary to decipher the priesthood first, and which was a blessing in disguise because it steered me away from going to a Catholic college to a secular college, mm-hmm. and that was a transformative experience in a lot of respects.
Mm. Let me ask you this. I was going to ask another question. I'm going to change it real quick. You have a wealth of experience through some of the jobs that you've held in the past. Just for the audience sake, can you name some of them?
Well, if we're talking about the early experiences, I was always looking for some kind of meaning. So, I mean, and I talk about in Clueless Rebel about the only guy in the block who lost money on his paper route. I know, a lot of very, very funny stories about being a total klutz and incompetent. But the one theme that dominates, I think, some of my early work experiences were this desire to do good. And so I worked in the hospital 11 to 7 as an orderly, and then would go off to college classes, you know, and fall asleep at 8:45 in my first class of the day, you know, routinely. And then I worked with neighborhood kids in one of the original war and poverty community action agencies, you know, and that was a gripping experience because these kids were just so incredibly needy and, lacking in all kinds of opportunities. So those things were very, you know, sort of moving to me. And of course, I was a night watchman for the Worcester Sewers Department. And I like to say that not a single sewer was stolen on my watch. But I did save the building from burning down on a New Year's Eve one day when a fire broke out. But that counts, yeah. But again, even that's a funny story. You have to read the book. But that was a partner that I worked with, and he came in dead drunk, and I had to call the fire department and the bosses and keep him upright against the wall when the bosses showed up. Wow. There's a lot of very funny stories about surviving. But then, you know, it was probably, those were less transformative than you know, the college years, the Peace Corps experience, the seminary. These were all things that where I was kind of bouncing around and trying to figure out a philosophy of life and a perspective. You know, as I said, breaking away from that early culture in which you were given a set of dogmas and said, this is how the world operates. This is how you should feel about ideas and people. And it was rejecting that and forming my own philosophy. And that's what a lot of the first book is about, but it's not written in a deadly serious way, although there is serious content. Yeah. It's written in a very funny, light way, and so people have read it just told me how much they've laughed and then even shed a tear or two, because there are some serious parts to it, like my battle with alcoholism, but it comes a little bit
well later. That's why I mentioned that in the intro in regards to being able to engage, but then also to be able to entertain. So that's definitely an important part, and that's the reason I'm wanting to ask some of these questions for the audience to kind of give a way to where and why they want to get their own copy of the book. But one thing you mentioned at the end there was in regards to what you were looking for, what was the moment that you did find, you know, what you wanted to do with your life?
I think it was a series of what I call epiphanies. There was not a single moment. But I can think about maybe just one illustrative epiphany I became very much engaged in the anti-war movement in the 1960s, anti-Vietnam War. During my college years, and I can remember when I had arrived at college, I was I still had faith in, you know, a traditional faith in God, and I still was very much sort of conservative on policy issues and you know, our role in Vietnam and so forth. So I was going through a lot of transitions in those college years, but I can remember one day, and I was awarded a National Science Foundation research grant, and as was another student. And we sat there one day, not doing our research, but arguing about the Vietnam War. And it was one of the first sort of arguments that I lost. I remember walking away, you know, from that day, from that argument, saying, "Well, we'll agree to disagree." But I knew he had won. I knew I would never again go back to the same belief system I had before. Most of it is a drip, drip, drip kind of gradual change, but every once in a while you have one of those days when you say, you know, I'm different. At the end of the day, I'm a different person. And then I became kind of the leader of the leftist organization on campus and eventually did all the usual, you know, crazy things that, that college kids of the 1960s did. Earlier in the decade, this was before things became more violent, which I would have rejected out of hand. I was not going to go that route, but I was. Yeah. I had arrived at an anti-war position.
Before I go to Wayward Scholar, one more question. What was India like?
Again, a profound experience. India was tough. The whole Peace Corps experience, it's well worth reading in the book and getting the book. It was early enough where, I think Peace Corps was still an experiment unfolding. And they took a bunch of us urban, smart, very smart kids. I mean, the people in my group just went on to do just amazing things. But started out with almost 100 people in the beginning, and only 25 of us or so finished up after 2 years. It was a grueling experience. India was tough, but I learned absolutely profound lessons about culture, the importance of culture, and it forces you to really see yourself in a different light. Plunked in the middle of a rural desert and a foreign culture that is pretty far from what you've ever experienced before, you learn a lot about yourself. It was not the easiest thing in the world, but I think to a person, we all decided after the fact that it was just a profound and an amazing experience. So, I could go on for hours about that, but I'm sure we'll run out of time.
No worries. Yeah. But again, just wanted to keep giving people reasons to get the book. So Wayward Scholar, Confessions of a Wayward Scholar. So you found your way. How did the direction turn into welfare reform, anti-poverty? How did things kind of go into that direction for you specifically?
Totally by accident, and I speak an awful lot about serendipity. And, when I say clueless rebel and wayward academic, I focus on the word clueless and wayward. I mean, it was never a grand plan. And literally, I'll tell you how I fell into the poverty welfare world. I was sort of at the end of my master's degree, kind of looking for a job. I got a call from this professor I was working with one night. Did you have a job interview tomorrow? I was in Milwaukee, in Madison, the state capital, for a state job. And I said, "What's the job?" He said, "I have no idea, but I know what room you're supposed to go to." I walked into that room, not without a clue what the job was. And it turned out to be for an analyst, research analyst in social services. I thought, this would be short. I don't know anything about research. I don't know anything about social services. But never underestimate the ability of people to make unwise decisions. And I got the job. And that got me into it. And about 4 years later, a professor from the University of Wisconsin, Madison, was running a big research grant through the state, which he had to do, get that particular kind of funding. The powers that be said, work with this guy, because no one in state government thought anyone from the university had anything to contribute to their program. Mm-hmm. So they sent me a lowly person to work with this fellow. When he got the grant, which was a very large grant at the time, he called me up and said, "Do you want to run it for me day to day?" And I thought about it for 4 seconds, and I said, "Sure." That got me to the university. And after that, it was kind of a done deal. I mean, that from the that big huge project sort of ended. I slipped back into the doctoral program. I got my doctorate in social welfare, and I stayed at a place that was called Institute for Research on Poverty, IRP. This place has been, I would say, the premier think tank research entity for poverty and welfare issues, created by during the War on Poverty days by Lyndon Johnson, and it's been a recipient of federal assistance ever since. It's the only one. There have been others that have come and gone, but this is the place that has stayed. And it was perfect for a person like me who developed a strong interest in issues related to poverty, welfare, the vulnerable, because I had a chance to work with the best and brightest, not only in academia, but with all the think tanks and the advocacy firms and the places where some of the better people think and try to change the world. So that's why the original title for the book was Candy Store, because it was like working in a candy store for me. It gave me almost an unparalleled experience to see the world, the policy world, as it changed from a tone which focused on what can we do for the poor to almost a war on the poor. If you look at what's happened from the 1960s mid-1970s at least, and what that world was like from a policy perspective to what we have today, or in recent years, it has been a sea change, and not for the better. But if you want to get a feel for what that sea change was like from someone who was heavily involved in the trenches, this is an excellent book to take a look at.
Well, again, actually, that goes into my next. Oh, go ahead. And again, what?
I was just going to add one comment. And again, people might say, "Oh, I don't care about policy. I mean, you know, it's all numbers and that's all dry stuff." This is not that kind of a story. I mean, there's some technical jargon and there, a few things that someone might, glaze, their eyes might glaze over. But it's written in a very light and in an accessible style. I didn't try to write this to impress my colleagues in academia at all, although I've gotten great, comments from my colleagues in academia, and they've written blurbs for the book. But this was a crossover book that anyone who has an interest in policy should find very instructive and also a good read. It's just a damn good read.
Well, I'm glad you actually added that right at the end, because what I was going to ask you, can you give us an example of a story of an individual that you met through your work, someone that you've helped? Can you give us one example?
You mean an individual that I helped, a poor individual? I have to say that my work was at the larger level of policy, so I didn't work directly with poor people, other than when I was a young man working in a community action agency. But that's the problem, not the problem, but that's the difference between sort of doing policy work and studying and trying to influence policy. This is more like the view from 10,000 feet. If I did affect people on an individual level, it was mostly the students that I taught. And I had, and in the beginning of this book, I talk about, actually in part why I wrote the book, that I taught second year social work master's students. And in the second year of their graduate work in social work, that was the year we decided on the concentration. And, and most of these kids want to be counselors, or they want a marriage therapist, or going to work with the elderly. But a few wanted to go in the traditional route of emphasizing social policy. And social work did have a great tradition of being involved in social policy. Harry Hopkins, for example, lived right in the White House with FDR, I think, put together the Social Security Act and all the other great, many of the great programs with an expanded sense of federal responsibility. And he was a socialist. But not that many in recent years wanted to go that route, but I had them if they did. And I would try to impart to them, you shouldn't just let the economists run the policy book. They have their tools and they have a lot to add, but they don't have all the answers. There's a human element that needs to be incorporated into our policy debates and our policy considerations. And I think I influenced a lot of them in a very positive way, well, to sort of really try to devote their lives to the same kinds of things that I tried to devote my life to. And it's essentially, I think if I made a contribution, it was that I brought a very diverse perspective to what I was involved in, what I was looking at. In most of the traditional discipline economics, it's all about incentives of the human being, as if they just respond almost automatically to positive and negative incentives. And if you look at psychologists or political scientists, they all have their sort of constraints, like almost cultural constraints, if you will, that their discipline imposes upon them. But I try to look at things broadly and take a broad perspective and to work with real world people as well as academics. So I had I could bring the broadest view to the problems I was dealing with that I could. And I think it worked. I mean, I'm sure I made a lot of mistakes along the lines, but you know, I was always a player in the sense that I was always being asked back to the policy tables, whether it was in Washington, D.C., or various state capitals, or up in Canada, or wherever. And, you know, even well into retirement, I'll get some calls about ideas that I had proposed in the past and interested in them. So I felt good about that career. The one negative, it's not even a negative or maybe a little threat, is that I didn't do as much writing because I was so busy. And that's what retirement has given me, is a chance to catch up on all the writing.
What do you think people need to realize about this subject overall in regards to welfare reform, poverty as it is, you know, now? Like you said, you kind of gave a synopsis in regards to, of course, the decades before, but now here we are, 2018, we're almost 2025 and things of that nature. What do you think people, you know, is there one thing that you think that people need to realize about this subject that's important to you?
Well, yeah, I think there's a lot of despair right now. It's probably the highest level among people who care about the public good, probably the highest level of despair that I've seen in my life, simply because it seems that the focus of policy attention has been on the wrong things, or it's being approached from the wrong perspective. If you look at America today, you could easily come to the conclusion that we're a disaster when it comes to public policy. I mean, if the litmus test for a society is that involves how you treat your most vulnerable citizens, and that's a kind of a traditional litmus test, the elderly, the children, the disabled, and so forth. We do a terrible job. Just take our healthcare system. We spend way more than any of our peer nations. And yet we have health outcomes that rank us roughly in the distribution of health care outcomes across countries on the level of Romania. I mean, that's terrible. You're spending gobs of money. That's terrible. And it's gobs of money. And when I say more money, I'm talking about, in most cases, twice as much as our peer nations for average outcomes. We still have millions and millions that have no access to health care. And what's the push on the current administration to regress even further? I mean, that's unconscionable. Our poverty levels, our child poverty levels, have always been much higher than our peer nations. Levels of inequality, where the proportion of wealth and income going to the top 1%, 2%, 5%, but whatever you want to pick, the top of the income distribution, inequality is higher now than at any time since right before the crash of 1929, which put us into a worldwide depression. And it's probably unsustainable over the long haul. We look at our policy on guns. I'm sure, if you read the Second Amendment, it always strikes me that the Founding Fathers were talking about a well-regulated militia because they didn't want a strong central army. They wanted the state to be able to have its own militia, because that's what they were concerned about back then, was another monarchy, the central government. They wanted to have power distributed somewhat. And yet that's been reinterpreted to mean that everyone can own their own AR-15. What that means, of course, what that has resulted in is 90 gun-related deaths, roughly, per day, when in other peer countries, many of them don't have 90 gun-related deaths in a year, and probably considerably less than that. And so you say, okay, why do we put up with that level of utter carnage? Either we are the most violent society on earth, or there's something wrong with our basic policies. You have to remember, people don't like talking about it. Policy is different than politics. Policy is coming up with the rules and the protocols for running a society, and they're not irrelevant. The policies we develop have effects on people every day, on a day-to-day basis. And the policies that have been adopted by many of our peer countries have led to much more safety, security, happiness. If you look at, I'm falling into a little speech here, so just shut me up when you want to. If you look at international surveys of happiness, of people who are happy, the United States is down the list somewhat. It's people like in Denmark and the Scandinavian countries, which pay much higher taxes, but they provide sensible policies and opportunities for their citizens. If you want to look at the old American sort of aspiration of upward mobility, you can be what you want. Anyone can be president. In fact, today, the probability of someone from the bottom of the distribution going to the top is less here than it is in those same Scandinavian countries that people say are socialist, because they have different policies that make it possible for people to get educations, and they have better labor market policies, vocational schools, educational systems, and so on and so forth. What are we doing? We're depleting our educational system. We're even going after the universities, which is still one of our best products for the world, and we're beginning to defund them at a dangerous level. The environment, a disaster. China is now way ahead of us in solar and renewable energies. And where are we today? We are still battling to reinvest in coal and other carbon-emitting energy sources that are of a bygone era. So, yeah, you know, I could go on and on, but those are things that we should be really concerned about. They're really, you know, potentially disastrous, and why there is so much, I think, this malaise among thinking people and policymakers. But at the same time, and I try to stress this in my writings, you never know what's around the corner. And so, yeah. You know, if you were plunked down in the 1950s, you might say, "Oh my God, you know, no one's thinking anymore." I mean, everything is very, you know, homogenous and so on and so forth. But the 1960s is right around the corner, and that was not a pleasant decade in every aspect, but a decade of change and renewal. And you never know what's around the corner. Might happen in the next election.
Yeah. And hopefully the audience today, the reason I ask certain questions is to let people know the background of an individual, especially on the publisher and author side, but also that you know what you're talking about. So that way when they get their copies of the book, they have a better appreciation of where the author is coming from, but they know they're going to learn something too. And as well as, again, have a enjoyable experience actually reading what the writer has written. So, Tom, I want to say thank you again for, you know, taking some time out with us. The two publications, I know, as I mentioned, going to give a glimpse of the work you have done and are doing currently, and give people a chance to see how your work has brought improvement in people's lives over a period of time. That being said, how can people get copies of your book right now?
The best route is to go through Amazon.com or BarnesandNoble.com and just put the titles in. That's the best way to do it. If you just put my name in, sometimes you'll get Tom Corbett Space Cadet, which was a series of books and stuff and television shows. Yeah, right. Back in the 1950s, I was very popular back then. But put the name of title of the books in, and you'll get them.
So, folks, Confessions of a Wayward Scholar and Confessions of a Clueless Academic are the titles. So make sure you type those in, and you'll see Tom Corbett's name on the books, and go ahead and make your purchases. Do you have another book in the works, Tom, before I let you go?
Well, yeah, really quickly, I have a third confessions book, Confessions of an Accidental Scholar. This one is some of my best scholarly thoughts that I've pulled together in one book. That's a little more dense, a little more technical. And I'm also working on another fictional book. My last fictional book was Palpable Passions, very good reviews, and I'm doing a sequel to that that I think will be called Ordinary Obsessions, and probably should be out by early next year. So I continue to write at a feverish pace.
Well, never stop writing, Tom, and I'm hoping that when those next books come out, you'll have some time to come on to the show again, tell us about them, okay?
I certainly will. Thank you for having me.
No problem. Take care.
Yep. Bye-bye.
Everybody, that was Mr. Tom Corbett. And as mentioned, as I mentioned in the intro, he's a very accomplished writer, and he just mentioned the title of his most recent book, Powerful Passions, which he was on the show talking about. He definitely has gotten some good reviews on that particular publication, and these next two books here, again, Confessions of a Wayward Scholar and Confessions of a Clueless Rebel, I almost forgot the title, you can find that on Barnes & Noble or Amazon. And again, one of the reasons that I have this series of authors on IMTN Worldwide Radio is because people don't read anymore, and they need to, and there's just so much that you can learn from reading still. It's a lost art, and it's definitely something that can be improved upon. And in his particular case, how he writes is on the basis of a lot of information, but he still does it on the basis of storytelling. And that's one thing I want to continue to try to push on the show for, you know, time to time. And that's why I'll continue to have my series of book authors on the show. So, again, thanks to Tom for coming on to the show. I can't wait for the next few months until the next couple of books come out. We'll see if we can get them on again per schedule. Look forward to more authors coming on to the show. If you are listening and you happen to be a writer and you would like to be on the show, you can always email us at chris@imtmworldwide.com. Find out how you could get a chance to be on the show to talk about your publication. Hopefully those that are listening enjoy today's show. Please support the show following us on our social media pages, IMTM Worldwide Radio on Instagram, IMTM Radio on Twitter, and please download and follow the Spreaker page where you can listen to all of the shows that are ever produced on IMTM Worldwide Radio over the years. You can actually start following individual shows on Spreaker as well. There's three shows around the ATL, which is sports-oriented. We have Women in Business, which if you are a woman who has a business, that's a show that you would definitely like to listen to, support other women in business. And then we have a show called The Top Five, which is fairly new, just kind of starting that one. That's a list show. Everybody loves the top five, top five serials or top five cartoons from the 1960s. I'm going to do a radio show based off of that and have a myriad of topics. So that's a fun show to check out. And we'll still have general topics on IMTM Worldwide Radio from time to time, so look out for that. We're also on Spotify. We're also on Google. The main page is blogtalkradio.com/IMTM Worldwide, where you can listen to the show live. You can call into the show. If you have questions or comments, there's a chat room, the whole nine yards. Very participatory in regards to the audience. So that being said, again, one more time, thanks for Tom Corbett for being on the show today. It's rare that I do afternoon shows, so anytime I get to do one, it's always cool. Those who are at work, those who are at school who should be learning something, but they're off in the cut, not learning anything, but you want to listen to something, it's always good to listen to IMTM Worldwide Radio. So thank you for those listening at school. And anybody else, but definitely please, one more time, follow the shows on social media, IMTM Worldwide Radio on Instagram, IMTM Radio on Twitter, and download the Spreaker app and follow the show there, IMTM Worldwide Radio. Till next time, we're going to go ahead and get out of here. Y'all take care. This is Chris, IMTM Worldwide Radio. Thank you.